Good afternoon, everyone. Now we begin with Professor Claudio Miquelon. His presentation is entitled The Third Victim's Participation in the Punishment of Perpetrator, a Return to the Logic of Goel Haddam. Professor Miquelon will have 25 minutes to present. Then Professor Martinez will respond. And finally, the floor will be given to the audience. Professor, his time begins.
Thank you very much. And again, thank you very much for the invitation. So thanks for the organizers and all that. But also, thank you for to Maria Guadalupe, because it's a fantastic book. And I'm sorry I'm not going to be able to make justice to the complexity of the book. So this is really an unstructured commentary to ask for clarification, to try to explain perhaps the source of my... Sometimes the argument felt very promising to me, and sometimes there are bits or junctures in which I felt slightly uncomfortable because I didn't have enough to sink my teeth in. So it's really a plea for clarification. So first of all, let me just say one thing about the book. It's a, as I said in the handout I sent you, the speakers, I don't know if everyone has it, it's really a breath of fresh air in this debate. For 40 years now, I've been used to seeing people talking about punitive damages, assuming a certain conception of punishment, which is predicated on deterrence. And then the argument has almost, you can almost predict the moves of the arguments, both in theoretical scholarship and in doctrinal scholarship. If it's about deterrence, that's the deterrence is a consequentialist argument about states of affairs, and we shouldn't subject the patrimony of the victim and the perpetrator to the collective good. So it's not about. So this is different. This is a breath of fresh air, I thought, and it gives us perhaps a new direction of travel to try to understand punitive damages. So what I thought of doing today is relatively simple. I want to. The general structure is to try to identify what is the normative remainder that torts and retribution tries to address. What is the normative remainder that neither criminal law nor a conception of tort law based on compensation or reconstitution of the patrimony and all that cannot address. So we have institutions that have been around for many centuries, and I think that part of the argument in torts of retribution, if I got it right, is that those institutions leave a normative remainder. There's a particular type of normative claim that's left unaddressed by the institutions as we have it, and punitive damages, perhaps other things as well, but certainly punitive damages helps us address this normative remainder. So that's the structure of what I'm going to talk about today. The underlying concern is a concern that torts and retribution brings torts, punitive damages in tort law, very close to something like retaliation. Now, I know that Maria Guadalupe many times makes disclaimers about that throughout the book. It's not about retaliation, it's not about vengeance, it's not about, it's not barbaric, and so there are lots of adjectives that qualify retaliation and trying to distance retribution in this sense from retaliation. And I think that the book does a good job of telling me that this thing, that retribution in this sense, is not a form of retaliation or vengeance. So that's, I think, conceptually sufficiently separate. Now, the trouble is that even if they are different concepts, they're not species and genre of each other, it's also necessary that what's present in retribution in the terms that you outlined is not shared with retaliation. So perhaps there, it's not barbaric, it's not about an eye for an eye, it's not about causing undue pain just for the sake of causing undue pain. All that seems to be correct. But I wanted to identify precisely aspects of the argument and of the concept of retribution that you outline, to see if those are not precisely the things that, leaving aside all the barbarism and all the grossness of retaliation, if that's not something that we also object to in retaliation. So it, retribution here is not retaliation, but if it shares those elements that are somehow normatively unattractive in retaliation, we would have a situation in retribution in which those elements would be present as well, and perhaps that makes retribution, in those terms, in terms you suggest, less normatively attractive. Right? Now, that's not a killing blow to the argument, I don't think, because you can say that if you shared out all the bad, bad, bad things, even if this is normatively unattractive somehow, you could still argue that there are countervailing considerations that allow us to justify this in spite of the leftover unattractiveness. But I wanted to have more clarity about that, so I started writing about the book. So I thought of doing two things. To start by looking at punitive damages, the role that they can have in punishment, the roles they can have, they can have in punishment. And sorry, just a reference, just very briefly, the thing about the Goel Hadam, Goel, is really about this idea that vengeance has been precluded, right? That there's something about retaliation and vengeance that for millennia we've been, many Western societies at least have observed to be distasteful. And in fact, the story comes from the Genesis. I like that story when Cain kills Abel, then God sends him off to fend for himself. And he says, look, when someone meets me on the road, they can just kill me. And in the logic of the Avenger of Blood, in that logic, not having a brother, he just killed his brother, not having a brother makes you vulnerable because the person who protects you is your Avenger of Blood. If someone kills me, the Avenger of Blood. And God then, or Yahweh, says, if someone kills you, I shall kill them seven times, or shall punish them seven times. So the idea is punishment and revenge and vengeance, retaliation, is taken out of the realm of humanity. So it seems to be a very old intuition we have, whether it's a good one or a bad one. It just clearly it's a mountain that needs to be removed if they are too close together, retaliation and retribution. Now, the first step then is to see ways in which we can think of punitive damages that I don't think are the ways you are suggesting, Maria Guadalupe, but at some points there are mentions of that, so I just want to rule that out and to... One might think the punitive damages are about, ultimately, the maximization of just punishment in society. That there are many sorts of wrongs that deserve punishment, and that criminal law is not equipped to deal with all of them, so we allow private actors to come in and take some of the burden from the state. And the reason why criminal law might not be able to do it is can be a trivial thing, like lack of means. We don't have the state constantly pursuing that, so there's a lot of money involved in the criminal procedure, and that's more trivial, but still could be a factor. The odd one is criminal law has some binds. So there are certain normative reasons why criminal law is not punishing every violation of every right. And they have to do with a number of normative, important normative reasons. So it's not about scarcity of means, but it's about normative limitations that bind the criminal law apparatus. So the criminal law is fundamentally worried about wrongs that have a public dimension. And private law, and therefore many private wrongs are just left unpunished, although they would deserve punishment for reasons that we might see. Now, I think that those two have to be ruled out from scratch because I don't think that's not, neither is it what, so it's not that punitive damages are second best to criminal law. It's not that if you had the means, And if there are no binds, you'd be happy with criminal law. The book wouldn't be happy with criminal law. And the idea is that if you criminalize conduct and punish in that way, you're going to leave a normative remainder. There's something that a certain type of violation of the victim that's not, is left unanswered for. Yeah? Okay, so there is a, the idea is that even if criminal law were capable of addressing all this punishment, bestowing all the just punishment, in doing so, there'd be still a normative remainder that only punitive damages can address. Okay, so for one, on the one hand, we saw that criminal law would leave a remainder. What about traditional compensation theories of private law? So, just a brief word before I, when I talk about this remainder, I'm talking about a normative remainder, yeah? There's something that's not psychological or purely psychological or sociological. There's a normative remainder. There's a kind of normative position of the victim that remains uncompensated. But so let's think about the compensation. Well, as you said in the book, I think you're right, the trouble with starting with compensation, private law now, so moving from criminal to private law, the trouble with starting with compensation in private law is that there are many institutions of tort law that cannot be explained in terms of compensation. So it seems to be, that seems to be a, to do a poor job of explaining those things. So think about nominal damages, vindictory damages, or punitive damages. Think about all those institutions in which, or think about cases in which you've already got all the compensation you could get, but you can still sue to get a declaration from the authority, even if you cannot increase the damages. There's a famous British case called Ashley, in which that happens, about in 2008, I think, in which you are allowed to sue, and clearly you cannot recover any damages. So there's a sense in which, and you're absolutely right on that, and people like Anthony Duff have written about that, that part of what tort law does is something criminal law also does, is to vindicate the victim's claim. It's a declaration by the community in which you say you actually had a right and the right was violated. Your claim to be wronged is true. You're vindicating your claim. Those are public declarations of support to the claim of the victim. And to be honest, you see that because in civil law, you might think that that's not the case, because in most civilian systems, damages are a necessary condition for liability. You cannot have civil liability without damages, but it's not true. And you can see that in a number of transformations of institutions. One of them is the institution of what counts as damages. In civilian systems, we started in expanding the concept of damage to the point in which it would be far-fetched to consider that those damages are compensatory. So nobody thinks that paying £12,000 to parents whose kid was killed is a compensation for what they lost. Nothing is going to compensate them for what they lost. What they're after is more than £12,000, is a declaration, is a vindication. So a lot of extra patrimonial damages. And you see those debates when people are debating in the 19th century and early 20th century, damage moral in France and in other civilian jurisdictions. Many people say, but there's no damage. There's just a, so they start talking about psychological damage and how that could be quantified. But the damage for the suffering or for loss or for is not compensatory. Normally, it's just we need to have a mechanism to vindicate. So clearly, private law has this vindictive element, and tort law in particular. But vindication could. And interestingly, because if for you to have compensation, you need to have vindication, because you have to have a declaration that, from the judge that you were wronged. It's tempting to think that compensation is accidental to torts, while vindication is what torts are primarily about. Yeah? It's tempting to think that. There's a modern way to think of the essence of things. Sort of Cartesian way, in which things that are statistically present in the object, they're part of their essence. They're not accidents. And things that are only sometimes apparent, part of the object, the type of object, are not part of the essence. So, there's something to be said about statistical and teleological, metaphysical outlooks. But it's tempting from a modern perspective to think, okay, if something is present 100% of the time in thought, and the other thing is present 90% of the time, the thing that's present 90% of the time is not part of the nature of thought. The other thing is part of the nature of thought. And then we have to look at vindication and look at the relationship between vindication and compensation. So vindication sometimes leads to compensation, sometimes it doesn't. It leads to nothing, or leads to something else, or might lead to punishment. Yeah. And in fact, that's the point in which... So Anthony Duff, I think, tried to articulate that a few years ago. He seems to think that all compensatory awards have an element of punishment. That punishment is the way in which you make the declaration have teeth, right? So it's cheap for someone to say, I support your claim. But if supporting your claim implies that I have to do certain things, that shows that I'm putting my money where my mouth is, right? So the punishment that the state bestows in criminal law, and for him, the compensation, qua punishment, is a way to show that the declaration is not simple or simply an idle statement. It's a statement that is meant. It's meant because I'm willing to put state power behind it, and so on. So it's meant as a proper act of... So it's a bit like saying, when you say, I love you, but I kill you. Yeah, so the old, I love my wife, so I had to kill her. Well, I didn't love your wife. You said you love your wife, but the kinds of things that you do if you loved your wife don't include killing her, right? So the idea is that for vindication has to be more than words. You have to show in actions you actually mean it, and compensation would be a way to do it. And if that's correct, well, then Maria Guadalupe, you're absolutely right. Because then that argument plays into the hands of punishment as well. So if vindication needs action, not simply declaration, well, sometimes action is going to be compensation. Sometimes action is going to be, issuing a certificate. Sometimes it's going to be punishing, right? So I need to give teeth to the vindication. So vindication in itself is not enough. There's still... it's still something else needs to do, but there's a problem here. And that, again, you see a moral remainder, the one you try to address. Because we could imagine that criminal law does it, right? We could imagine that a sort of criminal law light in which you don't have, the standard of proof is not, that's why there are two criminal laws. One, the other one is criminal law light. And criminal law light is the standards of proof, for instance, are lower, like tort law. And perhaps the concept of negligence is not as demanding, doesn't demand intentionality, but excusable ignorance and so on. So perhaps you can reduce all those standards, make what we do with tort law and punitive damages, and just leave the state to decide when to punish and to bestow the punishment without giving any compensation to the victim and without depending on the victim to do anything. So you'd have vindication, and you'd have vindication with teeth, some sort of, but a fine, let's say, some teeth, right? So the two things would be there. So, but clearly that's not sufficient for you. So even if you were to have a criminal law that is not in charge of the whole punishment, and even if you had to have a criminal law that's light, that... meets all the criteria that we have now for tort law, something would be missing. And that remainder is what I think the book is about. Well, not the book, but certainly chapters 4 and 9 of the book are about, and throughout the book. It's that remainder, and that remainder is not a psychological remainder, it's a normative remainder. So the question is, what's left, right? I think that the point that you try to make throughout the book, which is the breath of fresh air that everyone's been talking about throughout the day and will continue to talk about, is this idea that the victim must play a central role in the vindication. The vindication is not something that can properly happen, at least in some cases, without the participation of the victim. That if the victim doesn't participate, doesn't have some participation in the bestowment of the punishment, there is a moral remainder. There's a sort of moral problem or that it still needs to be addressed. Now, that's the core of the question, I think. So what is it that a victim has to do? What's the kind of participation? I'm going to focus on one thing. There are many things. But one basic thing in punitive damages is that the victim has to sue, has to decide to exercise a normative power. Yeah? And the normative power that it exercises is one that both includes two sub-powers, student-level powers, actually. On the one hand, you untie the normative binds that bind the state. The state cannot award punitive damages, cannot chase punitive damages, cannot do anything like that if the victim doesn't sue. So you have a power to change legal relationships that bind the state and stop the state from acting in certain situations. So that's a power. And you also have, coupled with that, a liberty. You're not under a duty not to exercise a power, or under a duty to exercise a power. Sometimes we are under a duty to exercise certain powers that we have. So in Hofeldian terms, you have both a power and a liberty to exercise that power. Right? But why is that important? Well, here's my theory, Maria Guadalupe, and I'm not sure if that's what you're trying to capture, so that's part of my clarification, please. So that's my theory about your theory. I don't know if that's what you think. So my theory about your theory is this. When the tortfeasor, when the perpetrator does something, wrongs you, it acts as if it had the liberty to do it. Or, perhaps more plausibly, it acts as if it had the power to unbind itself from the duty. So it's a general duty I have to many people that I don't crash into their cars by driving carelessly. And if the perpetrator, the tortfeasor, acts as if it could erase that duty. It was not under a duty. It had a liberty to crash cars and drive carelessly, right? And there's an old idea in reciprocity, in retaliation, but in all retributive justice, of some sort of equality. Yeah, so you try to restore an equality. So the barbaric ones, the an eye for an eye, that's obvious, yeah? So we're reduced to a situation of equality because I lost the sight of one eye, and now you have lost the sight of one eye. So I'm not defending that torts and retribution or trying to say anything like that. But there's some idea of equality that seems to be done, that seems to be built into the idea of retribution. And I'm trying to unpack what is this equality. And I think that, in a sense, the equality here is I was subject to your power. Yours was a factual power. It didn't have the legal power. And the law now gives me the legal power to subject you to me. I was subject to you by the force of circumstances. And now you are subject to me because the law makes you subject to me. And there's a bit, I quoted that in the handout. I'll just read it in case people don't have the whole book in their memory. There's a bit in which you say, the retributive response is thus primarily motivated by the victim's need to reclaim her self-worth. Through the imposition of punishment, by extracting a punitive damage award, the victim seeks to reaffirm that she is as worthy as the wrongdoer. So you can control me, but now I can control you. Right? So it seems to be this sense of reciprocity. The right to sue, there is this power and this liberty, coupled with this liberty, seems to be articulating a situation in which I'm put in the same position as before. Right? There's the equality between the parties, an equality in which each has found herself under the yoke of the other one. And because I was under your yoke, it's not enough that you give me back my car. And it's not enough that you reconstitute the freedoms and legal positions I had before. It's not about reconstituting my freedom as it was before. That has to be done. It's a compensation. It follows from vindication. It has to be done. But it still leaves an address that for a while there, I was under your control. And now you have to be under my control, right? So this is clearly a much more sophisticated idea of retribution than an eye for an eye. Now, the worry for me is still that the worry that I'm still struggling to get to terms with is why this idea of self-worth, my self-worth, has to be predicated on me controlling you, me having you under my yoke. Why we shouldn't see the first act of control by the wrongdoer as an aberration, not as something to be emulated, but something to be avoided. And we should give the victim everything the victim had before in order to reconstitute their self-worth. So if you lost certain things, we give you a number of things back so that you can get back the sense of self-worth. And we give you the vindication, the community is behind you. We know you've been wronged. But for you, it seems that it's not enough. It's important that now I am the oppressor. Now, I am a legally controlled oppressor. I know that when I oppress, I cannot oppress just like the other guy did by crashing into my car. I have to do it in front of a judge, and the judge is going to tell me what I can do and what I cannot do. But it doesn't change the fact that you, or as a tortfeasor, as the wrongdoer, you are now under my control. Now, I can see how that generates equality, but I still struggle a bit to see how that relates to self-worth. That I, in order for me to have self-worth, I have to have someone who is part of their life is enslaved to my will. Right, so this is 25 minutes. I just want to spend another 30 seconds just to say that I enjoyed this enormously. I haven't thought about punitive damages in such a sophisticated way for decades. The debate between deterrence, but poor, the victim is paying much more than that debate bored me to death. And if there's one thing that your book, many things your book helped me, one thing that it helped me to do was to start rethinking about this in a different box. So I don't have the answers. I have theories about her theory. I have concerns about how to navigate certain things. I'm not clear about the idea of self-worth and what's involved. But I think that there's a new direction of travel now that's been opened, and I wanted to thank you for that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Miquelon. Professor Martinez now has the floor.
Thank you so much, Claudio. It would have been very nice to have you here, but in any case, I'm very grateful that you joined us in the conversation, and it was very, very nice to read your comments and to hear now from you. And the first thing is that I thank you for describing so well the background against which torts of retribution was born in a way. Because I think you're right that it's like an old discussion that feels new, right? And I think that this was something that one of the reasons why perhaps it took me so long, and for many times it felt so challenging, and some of the issues that you are mentioning, and also a lot of resistance that I encountered over the years when I tried to suggest that I wanted to have a more genuine conversation on the justification of punishment, and particularly on retribution in private law. So some of the things you mentioned, particularly like the borders, what retribution or relational retribution shares with retaliation and private revenge. I mean, these were things that really worried me a lot. As you said, I mentioned many times that that I want to take distance from that, because this was something that it was very important to me. So I would say that what I try to do is to renew the conversation on the topic. And so I'm happy with people that are persuaded by the argument, but also I am happy if people who are not persuaded or were in the camps that you mentioned before are willing to get into the conversation. So I would be happy to see that happening already. So that said, I will address some of the comments and then we keep the conversation going. I really like your idea of thinking in a way of a normative reminder. And what I think confirms the idea that there is some normative reminder that relational retribution is doing is that when you look at civil law and common law jurisdictions in the practice of awarding compensatory damages, what you can identify in civil law jurisdictions is that there is punishment hidden under compensatory labels. So this reminder, this normative reminder is dealt in a hidden way. And in common law jurisdictions, you can see this in England and the US, because they are the two main, but just to give examples. And they call this substitution phenomena. And in a way, this phenomena is exactly showing this normative reminder. Right? So in the jurisdictions in the US that they have caps on punitive damages, or they abolish punitive damages, they sanction through compensatory labels. And in, for example, England, when you have a very restricted availability of punitive damages in the categories tests, what they show is that there are a lot of other general remedies that are doing the work or the job of punishing. And so this was one of the things that really made me feel very confident about the normative reminder and the idea that you mentioned at the very beginning. Perhaps compensation is not the main thing for the 90% of the torts. And the fact that the systems are trying to answer this in hidden ways or in different or in these substitution logics, it tells me that there is something worth looking at. And so this is what I would say about the idea of the normative reminder there. And so I'm trying to fill that vacuum in a way through relational retribution. And I think your description it's perfect of why until I reach the last step, that is the control of the victim and the exercise of the power, is not enough, and why the criminal law cannot solve it. And in fact, criminal law, tort law can go together because they are providing different responses and different answers. So this confirms that I need, the theory goes for more. And so, and this is where I think I'm very interested in continuing the conversation exactly on that, on what worries you, which is this idea of self-worth and how this self-worth connects with this need of the victim to be the one in control, in a way. And there, what I think your description that the defender in the first place is acting as if there is no duty, I would say it's more than that. Because perhaps it is helpful to think of the kind of wrongs that, the kind of reprehensible wrongs, in a way, or the kind of wrongs for what punitive damages are available. And we are talking here about reprehensible, outrageous, diminishing, disrespectful kind of wrongs. So it's not only acting as if there was no duty, it's acting in a way that recognizes the duty but doesn't care at all. It's a disrespectful way. So I would say it's a tick more than that. And so there is this, I think we discussed a little bit of this in the first panel, of asymmetry in this situation, in the sense that on the first place, the defendant is putting forward a behavior that is a serious one, a reprehensible one, a diminishing one, a disrespectful one. And so I think there it should, the description is stronger in a way. It's much more than the as if. And so there is this kind of balancing that takes place when the victim decides to exercise the power. And I would say that the self-worth or the affirmation of self-worth comes from the idea that the fact that you can, as you very well say, alter the normative status or the normative situation of the defendant by subjecting the defendant to the jurisdictional power of the court to impose the judgment. This, what brings the victim is the idea of self-worth in the sense of it can deliver a message, it has meaning, no? There is an expressive dimension that is very important in relational retribution. It's the fact that I can change your normative status says something that in the first place we were of equal value. You just didn't care. But this is a recognition that we have equal value and that I was worthy of respect from the very, very beginning. And this is the limited, you can consider, way I have to send that message. And so the expressive message is done in this way. Of course, it's not idea, it's amount of money and so on, but this is just to reinforce and to try to take away this worry about retaliation or private revenge. I think relational retribution shares nothing with retaliation of private revenge. All the time, the idea of accountability and answerability is mediated by an institutional setting, is mediated by a public authority. And this is something that retaliation doesn't have at all, right? And so this is something that it's important to me to express. And also because it's not subjecting to their control or to the will of the victim directly. This is done through a process. It's done through a process that has rules. It's done through a process where both parties have an opportunity to challenge each other, to challenge how things happen, to prove what is going on there. And so it's, in a way, a sophisticated process that takes place. And the other important point, and I close because I know I'm close on time, is that the punitive damages don't exist until there is a judgment. It's a new debt that the victim creates. And this is, I think, this creative power is what makes the self-worth of affirmation of the victim powerful in a way. And I will stop right now and we continue the conversation. Thank you very much.